accession number 20497, reel 3.
Richard Jones, reel 3.
Right, they were a wonderful lot, 19 Squadron, and it was actually the first time that I had experienced squadron life, which was a difference. While I was in 11 Group, we were all attached to a regular station, RDF station, and moved around from mess to mess and all the rest of it. And when I went to 19 Squadron, 19 were put on a subsidiary air force, or we could call it possibly a satellite aerodrome, where there were tents, Nissen huts and everything else. I mean, the messes were Nissen huts. We were in Nissen huts to sleep. The crew were in tents, the engineers, the gunners and the radio operators. And we lived as if we were on a big camp. And so we were all the time literally living in one another's arms. We were meeting the ground crew that looked after the guns, the radio and everything else. And also we were living in close quarters with the sergeants, the officers, and we all as one family. And this I experienced was very good because we all got on together. We were all doing the same job. We met the ground staff. We were with the ground staff. There wasn't any animosity with officers, sergeants, ground staff. We were a unit. We had a job to do. And I feel at the back of my mind, I have heard criticisms of feelings between officers and sergeant pilots and ground staff. But when you look at the wonderful work they were doing, you had to work as a team. And on my experience in both 64 and 19 Squadron, we were able to do it. And when you look at it, I mean, in most squadrons and everything else, you had sergeant pilots and officer pilots on the aerodrome in the flight dispersal units. Well, in fairness, when the day was over, the sergeant went to the sergeant's mess and the officers went to the officer's mess. So really, you didn't see a lot of them. But from my experience, if the sergeants wanted particularly to go to do something one day or anything else, and it was a day off, the officers would volunteer to fill in, and vice versa, the sergeant would fill in. And when you look at it, when you see an aircraft from the ground at 20,000 feet, does it make any difference whether it's an officer flying or a sergeant pilot? And I must say, when you look at the sergeants, because of the experience they had, they were brilliant pilots, and I have to take my hat off to them. And at 19, we had the same experience. We all lived together, and we were all a team. Of course, we used to... let me think. Oh yes, that's right. And going back to when we were at Kenley at 64, the height of the battle always used to be, for example, at Hawkinge Aerodrome, which was just behind Dover and near Folkestone. And I can remember that. Well, we used to take off from Kenley usually before dawn or at dawn. In the mornings, we get up early, have a good breakfast, and I don't know if it's generally realised that air crew always were allowed double rations in those days. So we had a really good breakfast, went down to Hawkins, so that we were readiness if the battle developed over the channel, and then we came back after dusk at night, landing usually at Kenley in the dark, which was a historical little aerodrome to get Spitz in because it was so small. But one little incident always amuses me. On one occasion we were down there, it was readiness, immediate readiness and takeoff, and my aircraft just absolutely, oh, I remember we had Kaufman starters, that's right, and my aircraft just would not start. Nothing made it start. Everybody else took off, and then suddenly the German aircraft came over, low over the aerodrome, and started to bomb the aerodrome. I nipped out of the aircraft very, very smartly, and at dispersal point that I was at, there was one small bomb shelter. And I can remember there must have been about 20 of us there, and we were all pushing to get into the bomb shelter. And I can remember, it wasn't funny at the time, but when I look back, I laughed quite heartily. But when you pushed forward, you went on pushing, and I can remember coming out the other end, running around the front, and we did that three times before the bombing started. Going in, running through, pushing for people, pushing from behind, coming out the other end, going around again. Funny now when you look at it, but there you are. Then another thing I can remember from when I left 19 Squadron at the end of September 40, at the end of the Battle of Britain, the end of September, when 64 Squadron had been reformed and was sent down to Hornchurch, London. And we were at Hornchurch till the end of the year. And I can always remember there, that was 64 Squadron, back to the old unit. Everybody virtually by the CO was new, and it really was a good unit. And from then onwards, we moved from there to Southend, which was Rochford, and we were there I was there till about April, when I was then posted for a rest. And bearing in mind that I had survived, I suppose, about 10 months, and the life expectancy in the Battle of Britain, I suppose, was about 7 to 10 days, I felt extremely lucky, and I was taken off for a rest. Having said that, I must admit that I felt the time, I must have been worn out, because on some occasions I used to make a complete balls of landing and go around about three times before doing it. But I came off and I was posted to Lossiemouth as a Spitfire instructor. However, I never got to Lossiemouth. The instructions were very, very rapidly changed, and I was posted to the seconded rather to the Ministry of Aircraft Production at Millbank. And I wonder what all that's about. So when the posting came, I was then lent in turn to the de Havilland Aircraft Company to be test pilot at a civilian repair organisation, which was de Havilland's in Witney, which was employing about 2,500 work people, staff, from all directions, from all walks of life and all the rest of it, which I found extremely interesting. And while I was there, it was a 6 month posting originally, and at the end of 6 months they asked if I could stay, and in the end I stayed with them for over 5 years. And from memory, I must have flown about with them over 1,000 Hurricanes and about 850 repaired Spitfires, which were built in Witney, and also over the time, I suppose, about 800 or 900 civilian aircraft from single to four engines. And although it wasn't an RAF station, I was virtually out of the RAF. I was the only serving officer with a civilian unit. And I was attached only to Brize Norton for medical, doctor, dentist, and parachute packing. And I can remember they insisted that I had my parachute packed every month due to the risks that went with the job. However, all went well. While I was with de Havilland's, I think I had the four crash landings due to engine failure, and one engine breakdown where five Conrads went out through the side on takeoff on a Griffin engine. And I managed to get that down all right because I was so low I hadn't got time to bail out or do anything else. And I did a forced landing, crash landing, unfortunately hit a telegraph pole on the starboard wing, and quite a lot of damage was done. But fair enough, these things happen. I got away with that without any trouble. But before getting home, I put on a brave face, walked home to Elizabeth, and never mentioned anything about it. And she was very surprised, and I asked her what the surprise was, and she had been told that I had been killed that afternoon in an accident up at the aerodrome. So I think she was quite surprised, actually. But anyhow, I'm still here. I still reckon that I led a charmed life. And on another occasion, nothing to do with me, but it was about 1944, myself and two other pilots were having a drink at Benson, and over the news came a thing that the night previously 550 of our, I think it was Lancaster bombers, were missing or been shot down. And three young people in the bar thought it was quite funny and said, "Oh well, no problem there, we can build those things now and they can replace the aircraft and then back into action again." And I'm afraid we were rather unpleasant with them. We really went for them and reminded them of the fact that it wasn't the aircraft we could care two hoots about, but that meant 550 men were probably killed, to which I don't think they would ever complain again about the same, or mention anything about aircraft being shot down again. I regret to say you have to bring these facts up at times. And on another occasion, I can remember that we were being, when I was with 11 Group at Kenley, we were being inspected by Sir Archibald Sinclair to congratulate us on what was being done in the by Fighter Command. And I can remember we were all lined up in front of him. We were 11 Group and we were flying Spitfires. And he congratulated us, this was the Air Minister, on flying of our Hurricanes. On flying the Hurricanes, and he congratulated 12 Group when we were in fact 11 Group, which I must admit didn't go down too well. Never mind. And another little occasion I can remember was I was talking to a certain club about 2.5 to 3 years ago about the Battle of Britain, a general sort of discussion, and one member of the club got up and asked a question: what would you do prior to going into a dogfight when you knew it was inevitable, all the rest of it. So I pointed out that A, I personally would land the aircraft straight into fine pitch, give it full boost to give it maximum power at fine pitch, and also trim the aircraft slightly tail heavy so that if I was shot or wounded or passed out or anything like that, that at least it would go up instead of down, and when it was fully stalled, perhaps regain consciousness. And so that was it. So he promptly got up and he said, "Well," he said, "I am very interested in Rolls-Royce, Berlin engines and engineering," to which I didn't dispute. And he said, "But from my experience of," he said, "I'm not a pilot, but with my experiences of Rolls-Royce and everything, I've read their handbooks and everything else, and it says quite definitely that you should not exceed 3,000 revs in a Merlin for more than 3 minutes. And also the same applied to maximum boost, as it would be extremely dangerous and you could permanently damage the engine." So I thought about this just for a minute or two, and I said, "Right, well, just imagine for a moment that you were flying the aircraft and you were in battle and you were fighting German fighters, and this happened to you. Be quite honest with me. If you were flying the aircraft and there was a German fighter firing cannon shells up your backside, be quite honest with me, would you pay two hoots towards the damage to the Rolls-Royce engine. And he immediately shut down. And I must turn around and say now that although I have been quite polite to this gentleman, that was not the language that I personally replied to his question.
Can I ask you about the various airfields you served at? You mentioned Kenley, Leconfield, Duxford, Coltishall, Hornchurch, Falmere. Did you have any particular preference for serving at one airfield rather than another? Or was it just all the same?
I think from an experience, they were all the same. As far as Kenley was concerned, for modern warfare, it was relatively small, and there were certain instances where aircraft were damaged, particularly in bad light and what have you, or bad conditions, by overshooting. Because in fairness, on a Spitfire, although you have brakes, they are convenient for turning gently, but you have to be extremely careful when you applied brakes, because if you applied brakes quickly, all that happened, you put the aircraft straight on its nose and ruined the propeller. And so this was another point. You had to be very, very careful on braking and not be too vicious with brakes. But I would say possibly as far as an aerodrome went to fly operational fighters in those days, possibly Duxford was the best. But here again, you had the best aerodrome there, but it was furthest away from the actual hub of the battle at the moment. So one countermanded the other. Hornchurch was very similar to them, and it was in a built-up area. And Southend, that was also very similar. And of course, I think now is the right time to possibly say that I must say wives were not very welcome to be in the frontline area, because I think they were afraid it might upset the morale of the pilots if they had their wives near. And I quite surprised the squadron I was with, which was 64 at the time, when after a leave in 1940, Elizabeth came back with me. And when we were at Hornchurch, she took digs in about a mile away from the aerodrome and was there the whole time. And when we were posted down to Southend, which was Rochford, she took a fully furnished bungalow and we hired it for the time that I was down there. So she was with me for about 3 to 4 months of the period, living at close quarters, and she used to attend all the do's in the dances and what have you in the mess. And although we hear on many, many occasions, I am not going to say here and now it didn't happen, but from my experiences with both 64 and 19, that one hears of the fact that the fighter pilots fought during the day and played during the night. My experiences were that we were pretty well knackered, actually, and although we went out into the local towns and had a drink and everything else, I consider our behaviour was remarkably good, and that we didn't do anything stupid. And as far as women were concerned, we treated women with the respect that they would expect. And I haven't experienced, whether it happened or not, I can't honestly tell you. Some people may have had it, but I certainly didn't experience it at all. But fair enough.
Did you ever come across people whose morale didn't hold up?
It is very hard to say about this, because the way I look at it, having got to the stage in flying that they did, to operational standards, if they had been unsuitable for flying in the first place, they would have been relieved as pilots and recategorized. And when they got there, things were happening very, very fast. I have no doubt that they were afraid and everything else, but I can quote one particular example, obviously no names, no pack drill at all, of a particular individual that quite frankly, quite a few of us really felt sorry for him because we didn't think he was quite up to the mark with the caliber required to be a fighter pilot. But having said that, how wrong I was proved, he turned out to be a most successful pilot. I won't say he was a high scoring pilot by shooting down enemy aircraft. He achieved his, he got a DFC and he had a squadron of his own, which proved to be extremely good. So I was completely and utterly wrong, and I don't feel justified to speak that way, because I often wonder with myself, did I show fear? Of course I was worried, but from my point of view, well, there we are. There was one case I had, I remember when I was at operational training unit, we had the, that we know of, the first American pilot put to us for experience on Spitfires. His name was Art Donahue, and from what I can gather, he flew Ford trimotors commercially in America from Toledo. And he was a wonderful person, and when we were at OTU, we shared a bedroom together, and as far as I was concerned, although he was an American, he was British and British all through. He joined up with 64 Squadron with me, then he went to other squadrons, and he did extremely well, and then he was posted out to Singapore, and he was the last Hurricane to get out of Singapore, going through Sumatra and all those islands around there, and gradually coming back to this country about the end of 1941, early 42. And unfortunately, we are very sorry, but he came back, joined an English squadron, and he never returned from a sweep. But the Americans came over, they were wonderful people, but they, when they had been with us, at the end of the Battle of Britain, they formed the Eagle Squadron, which was Americans who had volunteered to come over and fly with the RAF, and they were all Americans. And when it was first formed, Art Donahue refused to join it because he had been with RAF squadrons and had got on so well. And the temptation was, I think his pay would have been about three times as much, but he refused to join, and we respected him very highly. And also, of course, he did get killed with the RAF. And in the years gone by, another of his friends, and I believe his squadron leader in, who went Sumatra and all that way with him, for some reason or other, I've got the story perhaps wrong, but Art Donahue felt, I think, that things might go wrong, and he gave him certain things, including his watch, to look after for him. And many years after the war, and this is Wing Commander Jock Thompson, I'm led to believe, went over to the States, to his hometown, and passed over all his various relics, his watch, his ring, and everything else, to the mayor of the town he lived in, and had a wonderful reception.
Could I just go through one or two entries in your logbook, please? Mm-hmm. And perhaps you could give some background to what you've written here. I noticed one occasion in August 1942, you say, propaganda flight over Huddersfield to assist Spitfire Fund.
Correct.
Can you recollect that?
Actually, the Huddersfield should read York, did it?
Says Huddersfield.
Yeah. Oh, fair enough. Well, it was in actual fact York. I made a mistake there. Oh, and I think we may have gone via Huddersfield. But the thing is, that was the week that 64 Squadron were reformed and went up to Leconfield. And I can remember when we arrived at Leconfield, which was a training unit only and not an operational thing, we arrived, as I previously said, dressed very thing, but we only had our flying kit on, our leather boots, and the only thing we carried in the Spitfire was possibly our helmet, our cap and toothbrush and various bathroom equipment, razor, etc. And when we got to the mess, The sergeant went to the sergeant mess, the officers went to the officers mess. When we went into the mess for a drink after we had arrived, we were refused entry by the commanding officer of the mess because we were improperly dressed, to which I'm afraid we took terrific umbrage. We were wearing white, heavily oiled sweaters only, high-neck sweaters. We only had our rough uniforms and our boots on. We had no other equipment whatsoever. And the only thing I can say is that our CO took the matter up very, very quickly with the head off, with the people concerned at, I presume, Air Ministry, and the training command officer, the officer who was in command of the station, I'm led to believe, was very quickly removed. And within about 48 hours, we had an ex-fighter pilot who was badly wounded, who took his place, because a different way of behaving in a training unit and an operational unit, believe me, are absolutely totally different. And while we were up there, there was a big scheme going on for Spitfires for Victory, I think it was, and they were, in those days, a Spitfire cost approximately £5,000, and every big town in the country had Spitfire weeks where everybody was asked to donate towards the cost of the Spitfire and everything else to help the repairs and the replacement of unit of aircraft to the various units. And we actually, from Leconfield, the squadron, we went over and did a shooting up of, in my recollection, I feel I may be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was York, because I can remember seeing the York Minster. And everybody was doing various high jinxes and everything else. When I look back on it, it was probably highly dangerous over a very highly populated area. But we did these various displays over the towns to get people very closely associated with what was going on. And that is the reason why we were over there.
Another entry here for September the 23rd, you've put something, I can't read it very well, but it says something like Chester 109, 10 tenths cloud, very amusing. Do you recollect that?
Chester?
No, it says Chest 109, 10 tenths cloud, very amusing.
What date was that?
23rd of September.
Ah, 23rd of September. Yes, yes, that is while I was at Falmouth, Duxford, with 19 Squadron. I can remember that we were having quite an amusing thing. There was, I would say, 50% or 70% cloud and everything else. And when we were up, we knew the aircraft was there, and three of us were sent up to destroy or intercept the aircraft. And we could see this aircraft, and as soon as we got near it, he could obviously see us, and he disappeared into cloud. And we were anticipating, was he coming out of the cloud, and where, and all the rest of it. And I think on two occasions, as he came out, we were just about to attack him when he went straight into another cloud. Damned annoying, but there again, I mean, you've got to treat these things as funny, and if you lose your sense of humour, you've had it. So I can only presume he then got back home again.
Was this a recce plane?
I would think it was a recce plane, because it was near that area, round about there, and I should think it was a recce plane coming over to see what was happening.
When you killed those sheep, when you landed, did the RAF have to cough up? Were there any complaints lodged against the RAF?
Could I put it this way? We killed the sheep, and as far as I was concerned, oh, I omitted to say one thing. I was immediately taken to the doctor because of the wound in my leg in the High Street, I think it was, at Hawkhurst, and they drove me back. I never heard another word. Nothing was ever said or anything like that. And this is why, most amazing, as I said to you, I think it was on the 27th or the 28th of September, when I was shot down, and my being shot down and everything else, is not in any RAF records, museum records, or anything.